All right, we are in, I believe, our fifth lesson. Yes, lesson five on our Purity Pursuit booklet. And this topic is on purity of attire. If you need a spare booklet, there's some here on the front pew. We made it about the first half of the topic on Sunday, and just a real quick recap of what we talked about. Understanding purity of attire is to first understand that the body is God's property and not our own to decide with, and so we'll allow God to determine and dictate how it is that we are to present our bodies. And we started with Romans 12, 1 and 2, where we saw how important it was to God that we present our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. So if anyone ever tells you it doesn't matter how we present our bodies, that is in conflict with Romans 12, 1 and 2. We said that this would break down and understand what is modesty and what is nakedness. And they don't happen to be exactly synonymous, right? We mentioned that one may be modest and yet naked, right? As you might be changing your clothes in your privacy of your own room or taking a shower. That is not an immodest act. At the flip, also, one may be completely covered and yet immodest. And so we talked about how modesty really dealt with the inner person and their attitude, and nakedness, how one presented the actual fleshly housing that God has given us called the body. So we talked about what is modesty. We read 1 Timothy 2, 9 and 10, where he says, "I also want the women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, adorning themselves not with elaborate hairstyles or gold or pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds appropriate for women who profess to worship God." And so we defined some of our terms here. Modest being orderly, so it's clean and not necessarily out of arrangement or dirty. Apparel, it describes a lowering or a letting down of the garment, not a raising up. Proprietary being a bashfulness, so there's that sense of shamefacedness. Moderation being sound and self-controlled. We also reference this verse here in 1 Peter 3, verses 2 through 5, where he says, "When they see the purity and reverence of your lives, your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold, jewelry, or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of the inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight." And so we saw how that directly corresponded with modesty. It's the attitude of that inner self, that it cares about what is right in God's sight, what's of great worth in God's sight, as opposed to man's sight. What are some examples of modesty in the Bible? We talked about a few from Scripture: Rebecca, Queen Vashti, the Proverbs 31 woman. And then we turned our attention to addressing the subject of nakedness and how that was not synonymous with nudity, right? One may be completely nude, as Adam and Eve were in the garden before sin, but after sin came in, they recognized they were naked. They sewed some fig leaves together to cover their nudity, but not completely their nakedness. And that's why God asked them, "Who told you that you were naked?" They had this sense of shame that was put within them and was awakened when they ate of that fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And we talk more about nakedness from Scripture, that we want to seek to have our, from the shoulders to the knees covered, as that would have been the garment that would have covered nakedness there in Genesis chapter 3. And we left with this question: why is a lack of modesty and disinterest in biblical nakedness a roadblock to pursuing purity? So that's where we left off, and I wanted you to think about that question during the past few days, and that we would address it and pick up from there. So why is a lack of modesty and disinterest in what the Bible defines as nakedness a roadblock to our pursuit for personal purity? What do you think? Yes, Liz.
Sin, it's the I in the middle. It's that selfishness. We
or the current, you know, culture, right? You're from the old school, and you know that's why you think that way. And so your answer is the I factor, what I want, as opposed to what God wants. Good. Okay. So that definitely would be a roadblock. It's trying to ignore the fact that God has spoken on this subject profusely in the scriptures, right? And we'll just relegate it to what I define, right, as modesty. Good. Anybody else? Yes, Rich.
Interesting about this is that, you know, modesty is a constant, whether living now or 2,000 years ago.
Right.
Now, what we wear changes, but that concept of modesty doesn't. So we have to conform to that standard. Even as we go through the ages, we're
now. Right.
So the genetic man, it's now what we live in this time, now which this is what, that's what the world is.
Right.
That's what the world is. God's standard has not changed.
Very good. Yes. In fact, there in 1 Peter chapter 3, when Peter, we read the first part earlier on the chart, but when Peter was referencing modesty, there in verse 5, he says, "For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves." Now, Peter is referencing Sarah, who lived 2,000 years before Peter was even born. And he's saying, we can go way back then, thousands of years back in time, and see holy women who trusted God the same way we ought to trust God today, they adorned themselves in immodest apparel. And so, right, it's not based on, you know, passing of time per se. Like you said, styles might, you know, change, colors might change, but having this inner self, this inner voice, right, that says, I need to have a sense of bashfulness when I present myself publicly, that needs to stay the same. And then also the idea that I'm going to cover my nakedness as God did for Adam and Eve. Good. So if we don't want that, then that becomes a roadblock, right? We're saying, I'm choosing myself and my own desire. So it kind of goes back to what we were saying at the beginning, is I got to ask the question, if I'm pursuing purity, number one, who defines what's pure, right? God. And number two, whose body is this really? Belongs to God. So when I put that aside, I'm saying, no, it rather belongs to me and what I determine, what I decide. So that will always be a roadblock, right? It'll stop us from achieving the purity that God wants us to have when it comes to body presentation. Present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. Okay, good, good. Any other thoughts? Yes, Thomas?
TV shows or athletes or something, but, you know, like if they wear it, you know, it's fine to wear. And sometimes, you know, younger, you get caught up in that. Like they'll be showing it, like the NBA games coming on, and they show what they're wearing as they're walking. And I'll tell you the truth, it won't be long. They can wear a grass sack. And with holes cut out of the legs, and somebody follow the ministry.
Yeah, that's the trend, yeah.
But if you think about that, you know, a younger kid, they see it, and they think it's all right. And they see, like, talk shows or something on TV, and women come out there and may not be in the right attire.
Right, right. And like we've said with other sins, we can numb the sense of shame by repeated exposure of what God would have us to cover. It wouldn't bother us anymore. And that's how a lot of people are able to function today in the world. It doesn't bother them because they've been doing it for so many years, and it's normal to them. And so we have to, again, step back and say, all right, it may be normal to the world, but what does God want me to do with this body? Right? Not to be conformed to the world, but be transformed. All right, so with that in mind, we're going to turn a corner with the second half of this lesson and talk about this question next. Why does the Lord care so much about being a stumbling block to somebody else? First of all, what does that mean to be a stumbling block?
To cause someone else to do something wrong.
Okay, that's right, to cause someone else to sin. So why does the Lord care so much about that, right? I mean, isn't that the person's fault? Shouldn't they be in control of themselves?
He cares about each individual person. He doesn't want anyone to be lost. But, he also, we're subject to each other, especially as Christians. God's people are. And so, we need to look out for, we should not want someone else to be lost.
Right. Right, right. So part of the answer to the question is yes, that is that person's fault, right? They do have responsibility to be self-controlled. However, God says that I may do something by my actions that tempts them to have a lack of self-control. And the Lord was very clear about someone that would cause one of these little ones to sin. Better for them to hang a millstone around their neck, right, to be cast into the depths of the sea. So he's always cared about that, right? So why should we care about it?
Because
he cares about it? That's right. That's right. And we are to be the light of the world, right? The salt of the earth. And so we're going to think about that. What will my attire, my dress, my clothing do potentially to somebody else, especially if I'm exposing areas of my body that God would have me to rather cover. Now, here's where we'll talk about some of the differences in the sexes. Men and women are wired differently. I mean, that's just a reality. Many of the scriptures in the Bible speak about the dress of the woman. Not to say that the dress of the man doesn't matter, but it's because God understands beneath the surface, men are more drawn in by what it is that the woman would wear as opposed to what the man would wear. Again, it doesn't mean that they are not drawn in by that, but it's not of a small wick on that dynamite as it is for a man. There's a reason why most rapes are committed by men, right? I mean, there's some that are women out there, it doesn't happen very often. There's a reason why most of those that are put into prison for child pornography on their computers is men. Men have this stronger sexual drive that, again, God built in man, and that everything God built in man has a good way in which it to be channeled. But Satan's aware of that and can tempt man to go astray easier with that particular thing. And one of that is the appearance of the woman. So in Job 31, there, verse 1, if someone would read that verse, please.
I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman?
All right, thank you, Liz. So Job here made this pact with his eyes. So is Job at fault when he goes astray with his eyes? Yes, he recognizes he's made a covenant. He is in control of himself. However, as we know, this is in the Bible because men have struggles with it. They need to seek to try and overcome them. But women can tempt them to break covenants with their eyes by a dress or lack thereof, by which they show themselves and present themselves into a mixed public. Again, Matthew 5, 28 through 30. Jesus didn't write this with the female being the one being tempted, but rather the male. Again, Matthew 5, 28. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, is it not true that it could also read, but I say to whoever looks at a man to lust for him has committed adultery with him in his heart? Yes. Or her heart? Yes. But Jesus didn't write it that way. He wrote it the other way, the man looking to the woman, because he recognized that stronger drive that exists within the man. And he needs to be in control of self, but a woman can tempt or lay a stumbling block before a man through the sight of the eyes. Remember David and Bathsheba there in 2 Samuel chapter 11? 2 Samuel chapter 11 there and verse 2. It says, "Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw." So there it is. He saw. There's the action verb. He saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. The word behold means to set and fix one's eyes upon. So the eyes are the window to the soul, and they begin the engine within the man to do its work of lust. So, yes, men might need to be in control of their sight, but also it makes sense then why God then speaks so frequently about what the woman's dress is, because he recognized it could become a great stumbling block to the man. And if I'm pursuing purity, man or woman, I'm going to say I'm going to do everything in my part, in my realm, to pursue that, to work after that, because the body is God's property. And I want to pursue holiness with my God. Comments or questions about this here?
I was just thinking too, you know, I think it was last week they mentioned something about parents training their children from a young age up, you know, how to behave, how to dress, and so forth. And I think that's, you know, it's important for the parents to see what their children are wearing, for the parents to be wearing the right thing. But to see, you know, if the child leaves or is trying to leave the house with something inappropriate, then, you know, as the parent, they need to step up and explain why it's not appropriate. And if they're buying clothes, then they shouldn't be buying anything inappropriate. I know I remember one time seeing a young girl with a dress on, but all of her underwear was visible through the dress. I mean, she didn't have a slip on or anything underneath it to not show that.
Right.
It's very sad.
Right, right. You being a righteous woman that you are, you would look at her and lust after her. But a man easily could. The imagination can begin to work. And so, yes, that could have been a potential stumbling block there. Turn to page 36 here in the workbook. Page 36 there, under the section for women only, question mark. So this goes along with what we're talking about here. For women only, that first paragraph says, most of this lesson has been aimed at females and how they apply modesty to their lives. But are Christian women alone in the pursuit of purity in attire? Can men dress immodestly? Certainly. Men can wear clothing that is too tight, too short, too scarce, or too flashy. However, as men are more visually oriented than women, women are not as often tempted by a man's immodesty. So it goes with what we're saying. Next paragraph says, nevertheless, males aren't excluded from this discussion. We've already stated that modesty is a heart issue. A male needs to keep his heart in check when he's looking at females. And he needs to remind himself of God's vision of a beautiful woman. This should sculpt every young man's understanding of true beauty. It is inevitable that Christian men will be confronted with immodest images. Advertisers understand the male's attraction to immodest imagery, and they use that to sell their products. Television, internet, and every type of media bombard us with endless visually stimulating images. And this is a stumbling block placed in front of young Christian men pursuing purity. So those are some well-written words by the author of the book. So what we need to remind ourselves, as he says in this book, this chapter, that attire sends a message, right? It has always sent a message. Can you think of some real-life examples of that? Right.
And then there are various examples. I mean, you mentioned one in your lesson Sunday with David that I thought about, with the woman who went to him in her mourning apparel. And a lot of women in the Bible dress as harlots.
Right, right. So when I see a man walking around with a badge and a gun in the holster and some other things around his belt, I know he's a police officer, right? It communicates that message to me. If I see a man with a bright yellow cap with the bill out the back, you know, and a big long coat with some yellow stripes on it, it's a fireman. Right? I see a woman in scrubs. I know she's somehow connected to medicine or the medical community, somehow, some way, right? Because attire tells us something about the person. It always communicates a message. And it also communicates our purity as well. When we studied about David and his son Amnon that raped Tamar, before she was wearing the very beautiful colored robe that David's daughters wear, it says, "For the king's virgins wore such apparel." So it was communicating to the world that she was one that had never been with a man. But after that rape took place, she tore the garment because she no longer was a virgin. The man had stolen that away from her. So the clothing communicated such a message. Same with Joseph's coat of many colors, right? When it was brought back to Jacob in its tattered and torn form and the blood splattered on it, it communicated something about Joseph's condition. He said, "My son, he's surely dead, been torn apart by a wild beast." Well, the Bible makes it very clear in this regard as well that our attire can communicate the message of purity or lack thereof. So over in Proverbs chapter 7, you have the wise man giving instruction to a son to use wisdom and watch out for the worldly woman, and that he should avoid her path, don't even go down it. So there's his part he has to play of self-control. But he describes then a scenario where a young man was devoid of such wisdom. In verse 6 of Proverbs 7 it says, "For at the window of my house I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple, I perceive among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near his corner. And he took the path to her house, and in twilight and the evening and the black and dark night. And there was a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart." So there was a certain dress that this woman adorned herself to say she was open for business. Come and lie with me. As we read on further, though, we find out this actually was a married woman. She just put on clothing that communicated something different. She says in verse 19, "For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him, and he'll come home on the appointed day." And with her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as the fools to the correction of the stocks. Till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. So here the wise men spoke that this would radically change him forever. It'll take his life on an entirely different course, if not stop it altogether. Because he was found messing with a married woman, though she didn't present herself as one that's married. But rather she wore the attire of a harlot. It communicated that message to that young man. We actually see an example of that in Genesis 38, 11 through 26, a real life example. In Genesis 38, there verse 11, you read of Tamar. She was supposed to be given to Judah's son, but it did not take place. There in Genesis 38:11, then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown, for he said, lest he also die like his brothers." And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. Well, time passed. The son would have been old enough to marry, but she did not. He was not giving Tamar to her his son to marry, and so she took matters into her own hand. The Bible says in verse 14, she took off her widow's garments. So there was a certain garment that communicated that her husband had died. She took that one off and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place, which was on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown and he was not given to him as wife. And when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, because she had her covered, her face. So that was the custom there in that day, that if you were to present yourself as a harlot so that the man wouldn't know who you were, you covered your face, you sat in a particular place. And he asks, "Is that who you are?" And she said, "Yes." He says, "Well, let me lie with you." He said, "What will you give me?" Well, as the story goes, she takes his signet and cord and staff, so that when it is revealed later on that she is pregnant, she would have some insurance policy that she wouldn't be killed. And that's what happened. They find out she's pregnant. They didn't know it was Judah's child. And she pulls out those things, the staff, the signet, and the cord, by the man who owns these, "I am pregnant." And that was Judah. There's so many things wrong with this story. So many things wrong with this story. We can talk again about the man's self-control or lack thereof, right? His hypocrisy burned her, but not him. So many things wrong. But what we want to learn from this lesson is that the clothing communicated a message. So our clothing does the same today as well. When we go out with friends or schoolmates or sporting events or in sport ourselves, it says something about who we are. If we are a clothed and covered individual, or if we are more of an exposed and free expressing individual, not showing the restraint and bashfulness that the Lord would have us to show. Comments? Yes, Miss Nancy.
It is a story of many years ago. The sun still burns.
sure does. It's a living word, isn't it?
And most of the time, you don't realize it's too much.
Kind of like the proverb writer said, did not know it until the arrow struck his heart. Yeah. It's a good point. That's sad.
It is sad that man or woman, whichever it is, I got to find a hit flee from it, get away from it.
Right.
Away from it is harsh.
Right.
And I think, too, any young lady would be thinking of her future home. Who would want to make her home?
Good point. You know, and I'm really glad you brought up those points, because even when we're trying our best to do what is right, there can still be those times where we might, like you said, it's too late and we fall into the trap. So imagine if we're not even trying our best, playing very free and flippant with our bodies that are God's property, we're surely going to fall into the trap. And I was thinking about this illustration, talking about stumbling blocks. We were at the Brooks house the other day helping them move things, and I remember Marie said, now watch your step right there. I heard her say it, and yet I still almost tripped and fell on my face. The step was kind of, it was hard for me to see. It was white there at the end of the ground. So even though I heard it, it registered and was cognizant of it, I still almost fell anyway. And so that can happen even with the best intentions, right? And I think about the example there in 2 Samuel 11 with Bathsheba. It may not have been her intention to make David stumble, but there she was on an open rooftop, bathing in plain sight of David. A couple of sticks and a tablecloth could have covered that. Page 35.
Also, Steve, it's just good for young people to realize we only have one life.
Yeah.
We have one life. Mess it up, you're going to have a hard time for the whole rest of your life.
Right.
I think so often that we get older and we get to the point of prayer, we don't die suddenly, we have time to be late and be able to think about what have I done. The cleaner and the better you live your life, the more peace you're going to have.
Right. Now you're speaking words of wisdom. And it's really hard to get young folks. And I'm speaking from my kids. I can tell, you know, like, let me give you some wisdom. Oh, I don't want to hear this. You know, it's really hard to get a young person to understand that you've traveled this road, learned by experience some of these mistakes. And so sometimes, sadly, they're going to have to make some of those mistakes to learn too. But we're trying our best to help them, like you said, have the most peaceful life that they can, as much as depends on them. So we got to keep teaching. I mean, that's all we can do is to teach, right?
Explain to them the harm that can be done and how they can go back.
Right. Good.
I may break the gun and shoot you. I can't come back and break your life.
You're right.
I have to live with it.
Rest of your life, yeah.
This choice is what you make. Like I said, we don't ever like it.
Yes.
We can't go back.
So look at page 35, talking about, you know, having the best intentions, and yet I still stumbled over the little threshold of the door at the Brooks house. Here on page 35, intentions are irrelevant. And I really thought this was well written by Andrew Roberts. He said, you can probably think of someone you know who is an all-around good person. Maybe she can be considered a good girl, but her clothes are just a little too tight and her skirts are just a little too short. You know that she has a good heart and she's not intending to send an impure message. But what might an outsider think? The account of David and Bathsheba gives us an interesting perspective on one person's naivety. Can't even pronounce that right. Naivety. There we go. So, in reading 2 Samuel 11, we answer these questions, what David should have been doing at the beginning of the chapter, right? He should have been out at war. So David was already in a position to stumble. Now, what does the chapter tell us of Bathsheba on her roof? Well, look at that last paragraph. Regardless of Bathsheba's intentions, the fact is that David saw her bathing, lusted after her, and acted upon his desires, right? The man's desires when he sees a woman unclothed. Today, plenty of young women may be innocently tempting young men, or simply harming their own reputation by their appearance. These young women just want to look good in their clothing and may have no intention of sinning or causing others to sin. However, their intentions are irrelevant. It doesn't matter what your heart is saying if your clothes are saying something else. Men will make assumptions about young ladies dressed immodestly. And for that matter, women will make assumptions too. People can't see your heart, but they do see your appearance. Ultimately, it didn't matter what was in Bathsheba's heart. Her appearance brought about a terrible series of events. So that goes to what Miss Nancy was saying, that these things can have lifelong consequences that there's no going back from. And it's hard to imagine that you could trace a dot back to an immodest event in one's life, and yet that could happen for Bathsheba. Now, she wasn't, like I said, intending, you know, at least as far as we know from the story given to us, that she wouldn't know that David was out at that particular time. But it didn't matter, because David saw, as we read, this beautiful woman bathing. And he started the wheels in motion for adultery. So this is a great illustration to show what a woman's body can do to a man, how it can become a stumbling block to a man, and at the same time also teaching how men have to be on guard. Be like Job, make a covenant with our eyes, do the best we can, and pray that women will do the best that they can. Now, of the world, it's not going to happen, right? But among God's people, it must happen. It must happen. Over in Ephesians, chapter 5, God draws this contrast with the world. And he says in Ephesians 5:1, therefore be imitators of God as dear children. What's that? Pursue purity, right? God is pure. We're pursuing purity. So be an imitator of God. God, I'm made in your image. You tell me how I present this body made in your image. And we walk in love, verse 2, as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us an offering and sacrifice to God for a sweet smelling aroma. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints. So notice he talks about fornication, as we've talked about that with David some, but there's also this uncleanness as well. Talking about this sexual impurity. Right, this degraded morality. He says, I don't even want that to be named among you as is fitting for saints. I know what's in the world, but don't let it be identified among you. It's just not fitting for saints. It's trying to fit a square in a round peg hole. It shouldn't fit. It doesn't fit. These things don't fit for saints. Neither filthiness nor foolish talking. Right? So these things he's saying, we do what we can as servants of God. We let our light shine by how it is that we apparel ourselves, because our attire communicates something about who we are, not just our occupation, but also who we are with God, our purity as well. Any final comments before we end our class tonight? Yes, Liz?
Thinking about Bathsheba, because, you know, the way they use their rooftops a lot in those days, and I was thinking of the word location. You know, what she could have done, she could have done elsewhere, but, you know, it was a hot night and she was on the roof. But, you know, we need to be careful with where we go. Plus, there are some places you go where the attire is not appropriate, and, you know.
Correct, yes. Like, I talked about it a few weeks ago or a month ago about Gulf Shores. You have to be careful about where you go, right? Because you can easily see people in immodest attire. And so you want to distance yourself from that so they don't have to be in your peripheral vision. And it can be done. It really can be done. So, yes, we need to think about all those things so that we don't put ourselves near a stumbling block, right? Become a stumbling block to our own selves. All right, y'all. Thank you for the good study tonight. Study for Sunday morning, purity and friendships. Boy, that's a really important topic, don't you think? Who are your friends and why are they your friends? What do you gain from the relationship and what do you offer in that friendship? Great questions. We'll study that on Sunday, Lord willing.